Well, you're not going to want to miss today's discussion. Travis, we had a very awesome guest to have on today, James Silberman from Free the States, host of the Liberator podcast, to talk about abolitionism. Travis, what were your thoughts in that interview?
It was enlightening. It was, you know, it can be a controversial subject, tense subject. We're dealing with a loose series on abortion, so it's already tense. And then, you know, it's a different viewpoint in there, not always appreciated by pro-lifers. But I think, you know, he had some really good things to say. You know, we just ask our listeners to listen and to let us know what you think. But yeah, you're definitely not going to want to miss this one. Really good conversation. Again, it's such an important topic.
To
talk about.
Yes. So to whet your appetite, you have obviously the pro-choice, you have the pro-life, and then you have abolitionism.
And
so join us today.
If you don't know what that is, you're going to want to listen.
Listen today to the Happy Holy Hour. Welcome to the Happy Holy Hour, a podcast where everyday Christians grow in their faith through biblical examination and insightful discussion. I'm glad you're here today. If you enjoy the content you're about to hear, make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, and visit us at thehappyholyhour.org. Let's get started.
Welcome to episode number 72 of the Happy Holy Hour. I'm Travis, and I'm here with my co-host, Tyler. You know,
hello.
Tyler, for a lighthearted podcast, at the title, we do a lot of heavy subjects, and we are doing a loose series on abortion. And today we actually have a special guest with us, James Silberman. I got it right, didn't I?
Yep, that's it.
Awesome. So yeah. I don't know. Maybe we should change our name to the Solemn Holy Hour.
I think it's not as catchy.
It's not. But you know, I'm trying to think of. I could probably count on one hand like the really lighthearted episodes we've done. But we think this subject is super important, and we've already done one episode. Already where we had someone come on who actually had an experience with an abortion, and she gave some of her testimony, and that was really powerful. James, just being up front with you, we are pretty new to the whole subject. Obviously, we know about it. It's in our culture. But as far as really dealing with it hands-on, it was something Tyler and I, or at least I felt convicted of, you know, seeing it, knowing it was happening in our backyard, so to speak, and not really knowing how to approach the issue. And I thought the first thing to do is maybe use the platform that we have, as small as it is, to bring people on who are already involved, who can speak more authoritatively on it or share their own stories. And so that's what we're doing, hoping that it helps inform us and our listeners so that we can go and be more involved. But in approaching this issue, before we started looking into it, we really only knew of two things. You were either pro-life or pro-choice. And so this whole subject of abolitionism when it comes to abortion was totally new to us. So we're looking forward to hearing you explain a little bit more about that, what that is. And we are going to be learning just like our listeners on this. So just want to be upfront and say we're totally new to this.
Yeah. Well, real quick, James is an abolitionist. He's been an abolitionist since 2018. He's a speaker and writer for The Federalist. He's a co-host of the Liberator podcast. I was listening to that a lot today, so go check that out to learn more about this subject. But he's been with an organization ministry for called Free the States, and he's been working along other abolitionist organizations to fight against abortion since 2016 or so. He's been in this field. So we're really excited to have you on tonight, James.
Yeah, no, it's awesome to be here. Yeah. And I'm excited to talk about these things. A lot of the things that you just talked about, where you guys are at, where some of your listeners are at, is exactly where I was just a few years ago. And so, yeah, that's a good place to be, is that place where you want to know more. You've been exposed to the evil. You know it's evil. You want to do something about it. So that's a really good place. So yeah, I'm excited to share whatever I can to help you guys out. So.
Yeah, well, listening to Liberator podcast, again, I encourage our listeners to do it. Super, super good stuff on there. Their videos are super cool, and their studio is on point. A little nicer than our virtual studio, even the studio we had before we lost that one, but that's another story. But before we kind of get into some of your story, which I've listened to some on the Liberator podcast, and hopefully we'll get into some of that kind of you maybe highlighting you going from pro-life and working in pro-life organizations to becoming more of an abolitionist. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk a little bit about what that is. But before we do that, can you just share a little bit more about yourself, some general information to help our listeners get to know you?
Yeah. So my name is James. I work for Free the States. We're an organization in Norman, Oklahoma, but I'm from Washington State originally. That's where I grew up, where I went to high school, went to college there. And that's really where, in college is really where I was first exposed to abortion. I first saw an abortion victim. And it was the timing of it all was very providential, I think. I became serious about my faith at about 19, and then it was just a few months after that when I first saw what abortion looked like. And abortion had never even entered my radar in any way, shape, or form. Wasn't really interested in politics growing up. Like the kids who had like all the like Obama stickers and buttons on them, or the Romney stickers. That stuff just annoyed me. I didn't want to deal with any of it. I didn't like it. Then I just got serious about my faith. I saw what abortion looked like, and I just had all this. I had all the zeal for like evangelism and the kingdom of God, and then I saw abortion, and it's like, oh, this needs to be integrated, and this needs to be part of it. Part of what I'm doing for the kingdom of God is fighting to establish justice in this area. I just kind of got started at my college. I was writing for the student newspaper, and it was a small Christian school, a PCUSA school in Spokane, Washington, called Whitworth. And a girl in my Students for Life club came to the club and said, "Hey, like the school is doing some stuff with Planned Parenthood. Like I need to find an organization to do service learning hours through for my community health class." And Planned Parenthood was on there. And this is like a small Christian school. And so I knew that when I wrote about it in the campus newspaper, it was going to become kind of a big deal. You know, abortion, Planned Parenthood, a small Christian school. I knew it was going to blow up to some degree, but I was not prepared for to the degree to which it really did blow up, and just all this opportunities kind of doors open to get involved in pro-life stuff that was going on in Spokane and elsewhere, and just on campus. It just became abortion just became like my life, just before class, after class, during class, all the time, just talking to people about abortion. That really gave me the desire to fight for justice in this area. And yeah, it's been a whirlwind ever since. I don't know what the order you guys want to take this, and kind of how I went from there to go into a pro-life group in Ohio to then becoming an abolitionist in Oklahoma and kind of all of that. But that's just kind of a quick overview, who I am, how I got to where I am.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe go on a little bit from there. Like, you were in college, you graduated, and then you actually went to work for some pro-life organizations, right? And then through that process, eventually transferred out of that into abolitionism. And maybe that'll be the next step, is to talk about, because we've mentioned that word several times already.
Yeah.
And if listeners are like me before listening to Liberator podcast, I just associated abolitionism with slavery. I actually, about a stone's throw from where I'm sitting, I'm right next to a cabin that was part of the Underground Railroad here at the camp I work at. And so we have a museum there, and so heavily influenced by abolitionism there, but I never even would have connected the word to the abortion debate. So definitely maybe talk about the history of abortion and how that ties into our modern fight against abortion today. But before that, maybe, yeah, just share a little bit of what happened after college and how you actually went into this full time.
Right. So I got various opportunities. I was speaking at like pregnancy center banquets and stuff after the whole the campus newspaper situation. And so just various doors were opening up. And as I was looking at kind of the options of places I could go volunteer, places I could go work, I just had a conviction that I wanted something very serious, that I thought treated abortion with the gravity that it deserved. And so there was a group in Ohio called Created Equal. And that's kind of where I went to go. And it's basically just evangelism, street activism, campus activism. And we basically show the abortion victims. And as someone who was awakened to the horror of this by seeing abortion, I thought that was a good, that was a very good thing, that our culture needs to be confronted with this in all of its, bloody horror. So I went and worked this group for a couple of years. It's a good group. There's a lot of good people there. A lot of people I still consider really good friends there. They are a pro-life organization. And during my internship, so during my first few months there, the topic of abolitionism came up, and I could tell right off the bat that my employers were not super comfortable around or talking about abolitionists or really addressing the issue. I could tell there was some friction there. And so I was just kind of interested. I wanted to go learn more. So I did. I befriended some abolitionists on Facebook. A few months after that, there was a big abolitionist project in Seattle. It was pretty cool. They put all these origami butterflies all around the city, like 10,000 of them. And it kind of blew up like the online message boards and stuff. And everyone was wondering what the heck it was. And then it turned out to be, an abolitionist project. And we all came out with the same symbol that was on the butterflies. It was pretty cool. And I'm from the Seattle area. And so I went out and I met abolitionists there for the first time. And so they just explained the ideas and it made sense. And this is winter of 2018. So about just a few months before I'm moving to Ohio full time after the internship to join the staff, at Created Equal. And so right off the bat, from the beginning of my time as a full time employee of Created Equal, I'm wrestling with these ideas, that we shouldn't compromise with abortion. That we should be explicitly Christian in our argumentation against abortion. And so I'm wrestling with these ideas, but I'm not even aware yet of the degree to which there's friction between pro-lifers and abolitionists. But then as I'm working for this organization and I start pressing, hey, can we go support this bill of total abolition? And it would just kind of get shut down every time for different reasons. And then that happened enough. And then, so I was kind of starting to get frustrated with that. And then I got a position writing for The Resurgent. And I told them, hey, I'm an abolitionist now. I'm going to be writing, abolitionist things at this other publication. And, I wrote my first abolitionist article there, and I criticized pro-life leaders in Oklahoma for fighting against the abolition bill here. And that was pretty much the last straw, criticizing another pro-life organization, another pro-life lobbyist. That's a big no-no. And so, that basically, got shown the door after that. And so that was a disappointing thing, but it just kind of was what it was. So
for our listeners out there that may not really understand, myself included, as of a few days ago, but can you explain the difference between what being pro-life is versus what being an abolitionist is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I would say there's probably more sub-distinctives, but I would say there's kind of two categories of the distinctions. One, abolitionists are explicitly Christian, and so we make no bones about that. The pro-life movement disagrees with that. Like there's a secular pro-life, there's Mormon pro-lifers, there's all sorts of different, it's basically whatever your theological beliefs are, let's just agree that, that abortion's wrong and let's kind of leave the gospel out of it. And they're very certain of that. And abolitionists disagree. We think that the gospel is where our power comes from. We think the gospel is the key to revival, and revival is the key to abolishing abortion. And so we're not gonna leave the gospel out of it. We're gonna lead with the gospel. We're not gonna kind of bring it in through the back door or just kind of leave it aside entirely. We're gonna be explicitly Christian in our argumentation. We're gonna be explicitly Christian in our lobbying, and our legislation is gonna be consistent with God's word. And we're going to be just foundationally Christian, whereas the pro-life movement does not agree with that. They think it's just, we should just all agree that abortion is wrong. And that's not to say that we don't want, atheists or other people to support abolition bills or abolition candidates. We want that, people can operate with common grace and come to right conclusions. But ultimately, abortion is sin. The cure to sin is the gospel. And so no one has the cure except for the Church of Jesus Christ. And so this has to be a Christian, gospel-centered endeavor. And so we think that's really important. Next would be we don't compromise with abortion. And this is another point of a lot of friction with the pro-lifers, because they want to pass bills that say, well, you can have an abortion up to 20 weeks and then not after 20 weeks. Or they want to pass a bill saying you can have an abortion, but the abortion clinic hallways have to be this wide. Or the instruments have to be sterile. Or they want to regulate abortion in certain ways to try to bring the numbers down. Whereas abolitionists say, no, when you write laws that are inconsistent with God's word, inconsistent with the Constitution, you're completely giving up your foundations. You're ceding the entire foundation of the argument to the other side. You're teaching people that pain capability at 20 weeks is what makes a human being valuable. You're teaching people that a heartbeat is what makes human beings valuable. And that was a point that I learned very intimately when I was meeting with my Ohio state senator when I lived in Ohio. And I talked to his office, or I was talking to his aide, and I said, hey, here's what an abolition bill is. Here's why we need one. And her response was, It's Senator Brenner's personal religious conviction that life begins at a heartbeat. Now that's ridiculous, right? Scientifically, morally, that is awful. But where does an idea like that come from? That comes from Senator Brenner, Andrew Brenner, championing the heartbeat bill for 6 years in Ohio. That's where an idea like that comes from. And so because the law is a tutor, we're teaching people things with the laws that we write. Mm-hmm. And so we think it's very important that our laws are consistent with God's word, that our laws say that abortion is murder, and that there will not be allowances for it. There will not be any difference in the treatment between preborn humans and born humans, that there should be equal protection under the law. And we're not going to compromise on that politically. And that's a major point of clashing with pro-life groups. And that's, as a lobbyist, that's my main point of contention with pro-life, interacting with pro-life politicians, is that they want to compromise. And another problem with it is that there's an infinite amount of ways to regulate abortion. You can regulate the instruments, the hallways, 20 weeks, 19 weeks, 18 weeks, 17 weeks. It's infinite the amount of ways that you can say, here's a bill that would, you know, save some lives. And they can do that until the year 3000 without running out of ideas to regulate abortion. And every time they pass one, it's a huge pro-life victory. And what that does is it makes us complacent with legislation that really isn't doing much of anything. In Oklahoma, we have a bill to abolish abortion. They kill that bill, but in order to get away with killing that, because people are mad at them for killing the bill of abolition, what they have to do is they have to put forward 6 incremental pro-life bills in its place, and that's what helps them save their careers after preventing abortion from being abolished. And so it's very important that we reject those pro-life bills, because those are what are delaying abolition. They're what are teaching the culture unjust, untrue things. They're what are allowing pro-life politicians to keep abortion legal and still get reelected by professing pro-lifers. We think that we should not compromise with abortion. We think that there should be complete equality under the law.
So can you explain a little bit of the history of abolitionism, maybe even going back a little bit to the fundamentals of abolition dealing with slavery and then applying that today? Because listening to you guys, it did seem like there was a lot of comparisons, you know, when you had different parties, immediatism and incrementalism and some of the different parties almost mirror the ones today. And I think that would be really key. I think it was key for me starting to understand where you guys were coming from. And obviously, you know, the name of your podcast and a lot of your graphics, all these things is very heavily tied to the history of abolitionism. So understanding that helps us understand what you're getting at today, maybe.
Yeah, no, it's an awesome topic. So, Russell, my colleague and co-host on The Liberator, about 12 years ago, he was reading about the abolitionists of slavery, because he was getting his PhD in the history of science, and a bunch of people in his department were promoting this book that basically said that Charles Darwin was motivated, you know, in his research about macroevolution, he was motivated by a desire to abolish slavery. And Russell's like, well, I don't think that's quite right. I don't think the abolitionists were very Darwinian. And so he goes and he reads, he's reading the abolitionists, he's reading Garrison, he's reading Wilberforce and Clarkson and Hayek and Bryant Green and all these people. And then at roughly the same time, his church was doing what they called it a round table. And they basically just brought up different topics and someone would do a bunch of research and give a presentation on a topic. And so at the same time that he was researching the abolitionists and Darwin, he was also asked to go do research on the pro-life movement and talk to the rest of the roundtable about how they can be involved in fighting abortion. And what he discovered as he was reading the abolitionists and reading the pro-lifers, he realized there's very, very little in common between them. And further, he realized that the abolitionists actually opposed, just as vociferously as they opposed the slave owners, they opposed the incrementalists, basically the pro-lifers of their time. Like, for instance, William Lloyd Garrison, who was the publisher of The Liberator, which is what our podcast is named after, and he was one of the leading, probably the leading abolitionists of slavery in America. He wrote in a letter that he viewed the downfall of the American Colonization Society, which was the incrementalists, he viewed the downfall of them and the downfall of slavery as one and the same. Mm-hmm. And so he viewed this incrementalism, he called it a cruel, dangerous, and delusive scheme that was basically just causing complacency in the church, causing just a comfortability with compromise, and an unchristian worldview. And so really he's reading the abolitionists and pro-lifers at the same time. And he just has a, I don't know, there's a moment where it clicked and he's like, we've got to reform the way that we fight abortion. And so, yeah, he basically, you know, just started a movement basically out of his church, and then expanded far beyond that. But anyways, it was reading Garrison, it was reading Heyrich and all these people that helped him see that that the pro-lifers are not going about this rightly. The abolitionists, as I said, they were immediatists. They rejected incrementalism, they viewed the incrementalists of their time as just as much an enemy of abolition as the slave owners of their time. Now that's a harsh, that's hard for me to even say, right? Implying that that's the pro-life movement. Mm-hmm. But then you go up to a hearing on a bill to abolish abortion, and you see National Right to Life testifying against it. And it's like, well, it kind of is the case. It just is, you know, and I get no joy out of saying this or exposing this or anything. It's not fun. I have a lot of friends who are pro-life. There are a lot of good people in that movement, but, it is delaying abolition. It is, teaching injustice. I highly recommend people, read, if someone's interested in reading, about the abolitionists historically, but my first resource would be Immediate, Not Gradual Abolition by Elizabeth Heyrich. That was actually the pamphlet that kind of put me over the edge on abolitionism. I was kind of at like 90% there for a while, and then I read that and it was like, it's over. Can't compromise anymore. So Immediate, Not Gradual Abolition by Heyrich, I really, really recommend for anyone who wants to learn more about the slavery abolitionists.
And we'll put that in the show notes so that if you are listening and you want to check it out, go to the show notes. But it's interesting. There's a lot of similarities when you think about, like, in our 21st century mindset, and you think about slavery, you know, 150 years ago, of course, if you were anti-slavery, you'd be like, no, I want to stop it now. Not just, oh, we'll stop it over the course of the next 20 years and in little steps. But like, it could be so easy to say, yeah, let's stop slavery now. But then you put it, when you put that on abortion, people are like, oh no, we can't do that. We have to take, it's just a very interesting comparison. And when I think it's easier to understand the abolition movement when you compare it to the slavery and the abolitionists of that day too.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things the pro-lifers, often kind of claim William Wilberforce as kind of their inspiration or someone who would be on their side. But it's like, well, the pro-life lobbyists who are incrementalists, they're not Wilberforce. They're Henry Dundas, who's the guy in Amazing Grace who stands up and says, I agree with Mr. Wilberforce on the abolition of the slave trade, but it must be done gradually. And then he votes to kill Wilberforce's bill to abolish the slave trade. Mm. It's like, no, the problem isn't Wilberforce. They're Henry Dundas. They're the people standing up and saying, no, it should not be done immediately. It should be done gradually. I take no joy in saying that, but it's just the reality of the situation.
How would you respond? And I'm trying to, I guess I'll just have to paraphrase. I can't remember exactly what they said. I think it was in response to maybe a debate that Russell Hunter did, but they said that Wilberforce and other abolitionists were immediatists in their ideology, but in practice they were incrementalists, pointing to the fact that Wilberforce did, and I can't verify this, but this is what they said, that he did vote for incrementalist bills, you know, to make conditions on the ships better and these different things. And they would say, well, you know, we're all abolitionists, you know, that's our ideal, but they would say it's not possible now, which I think you would argue it is, but they say it's not. So what our job is to save what we can now in hopes that when the time is right, when we can get enough votes, those different things, we'll abolish it. And I think in answering that, maybe talk a little bit more and help convince our listeners that or give some examples of when pro-lifers have actually stop bills from passing like they would have passed, it was possible, and then they kind of stood in the way of making that happen. Because when I hear them say, you know, if it was possible, of course we'd vote for it, we'd do that, but, and then when it is possible, they don't. That was my problem. Maybe that's not all pro-lifers, but certainly some.
Right.
Sorry, there's a lot in there.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. I'll tackle it point by point, and then if I miss one,
sure.
Tell me to come back to it. But yeah, no, they say it's not possible now, and their main reason for saying that is because, and I sometimes feel like I'm overstating this, but I don't actually think I am. I mean, they view the Supreme Court's authority as completely unconditional. Like, they don't think there's any justification ever for standing up to the Supreme Court and saying, no, that's wrong, and we're not going to abide by it. And so, like, in a state like Oklahoma, we've got more than 80% of the state legislature are pro-life Republicans. The governor, the attorney general, the lieutenant governor, all pro-life Republicans. There's no reason an abolition bill couldn't pass if those pro-lifers set their mind on abolishing abortion. But the problem is that they don't have their mindset on abolishing abortion. They have their mindset on regulating abortion, and they get backed up in that regulation of abortion and opposing abolition. They get the backing of Oklahomans for Life, of Tony Lowinger, and they get the backing of Oklahoma Faith Leaders. I forget the leader of that organization's name. But they get the backing of these pro-life groups, which allows them to keep opposing abolition. And so, yeah, I mean, the only thing standing in the way of, I mean, they'll say it's not possible, but the only thing standing in the way is them. Like, they're the ones making it not possible. I mean, it's not just Oklahoma. I mean, it's in Texas. You've got major pro-life Republican majorities everywhere in Texas, in Idaho, in Missouri, in Indiana. In almost every state where an abolition bill has been introduced, you've got huge pro-life majorities and a pro-life governor and attorney general. I think Washington would be the only state that was not the case. And in every other state, you've got Republican pro-life majorities in both chambers and a Republican governor. And so it is pro-lifers who are standing in the way of abolition. And then what was next? So I think there was a question about Wilberforce.
I guess the question was, they in response to a point that Russell brought up about the the abolitionists being immediate, they would respond, well, they were that way in their ideology, but in practice, you know, they were incrementalist, pointing to the fact that he did vote for some of these bills to, you know, regulate slavery to some extent.
Yeah. So that is something I've heard them say as well. So there's a couple things with Wilberforce. So the first one I would say is he was never campaigning for any gradual measure. He was always putting forward his immediate abolition bill. Now, there were other things that he may have voted for, like Amazing Grace made it seem like he was the principal architect and the one who put forward that bill that regulated the flags on the slave ships and stuff like that. He wasn't actually the one who filed that. But even if he had voted for that, there are other things related to that where he might have been supporting that bill in order to take away the argument from the pro-slavery side that, well, if we abolish the slave trade, then France will just step in and fill the market.
So in other words, he was proving that it doesn't matter what all these bills do, slavery is still going to exist. We need to abolish it completely.
Yeah, he was taking away pro-slavery arguments. Or the flag bill took away a lot of the pro-slavery arguments, and that may have helped to abolish slavery. But even if he wasn't, like, say, the strict immediatist in his early years that, say, a William Lloyd Garrison or an Elizabeth Heirich was, in his later years, he definitely was. Because in the mid-1830s, there was a big abolition event after abolition had been achieved in Britain. They invited some American abolitionists over, and they had a big kind of brainstorming session and banquet and all this stuff. And they invited both William Lloyd Garrison, and they also invited one of the leaders of the American Colonization Society, because they viewed them as the incrementalists. They viewed them as people who were fighting abortion as well. And so Garrison comes into this thinking, man, I've got to teach the British abolitionists that the American Colonization Society is bad news. And so he basically challenges the ACS guy to a debate. And he basically has this little sheet that he publicizes that explains all the problems with incrementalism and the American Colonization Society. And basically the guy gets sent home at the prompting of Wilberforce and other, the ACS guy gets sent home, the incrementalist, gets sent back across the Atlantic after, you know, I don't know how long the journey across the Atlantic took back then, but they basically just tell him, go home, like you're not basically wanted anymore. And so when the situation came up in his later years to choose between, will I endorse the American abolitionists, immediatists, or will I endorse the incrementalists? Wilberforce and the British abolitionists more broadly chose to back the American abolitionists. Certainly in his later years, he was a full-blown abolitionist, immediatist, I would say for sure.
And so. And you're saying almost all or all American abolitionists were immediatists?
Yes. So people in America pretty much knew that the abolitionism was synonymous with immediatism. Like there was the American Colonization Society and other kind of nominal anti-slavery people who were incrementalists. But when you said abolitionists, people knew you meant the Garrisonians.
So James, you work for a organization called Free the States, and you guys have some central tenets for your for abolitionist movements and what you guys really stand for. I was looking through them on your website, but I would love for you to kind of give us an explanation of those tenets if you can, and kind of help our listeners understand what you guys are really standing on.
So we are called Free the States. So we are working to free the states from their participation in the American abortion Holocaust, kind of the longer version of our name. And so on our website, you know, it says we are trying to assert state sovereignty to abolish abortion. Now, the reason for asserting state sovereignty to abolish abortion is because you would have to be, it's kind of the definition of insanity to keep relying on the federal courts to kind of right their own wrongs on this. You know, they've proven over 48 years, they've had 38 abortion-related cases come before the Supreme Court, and every single one has resulted in Roe being upheld, illegal abortion being continually forced on the states. And so the idea that we're going to continue to wait for the federal courts to fix their own problem, we just don't think is a good, wise route to go. And so we are trying to assert state sovereignty. We're saying that the states should uphold the Constitution, even if the Supreme Court is telling them not to. The states should obey Christ, even if the Supreme Court is telling them not to. And so we are mostly focused on state-level efforts to abolish abortion. Now we are as we talked about a little bit, we're abolitionists. We're not pro-life. In episode 10 of the Liberator podcast, we talked about why it's important to draw that line of distinction. And just real briefly, in Republican primaries, there are going to be abolitionist Republicans and there's going to be pro-life Republicans. And so when you're challenging an incumbent pro-life Republican, you're not going to have the money, the connections, the name recognition. You're not going to have the backing of the political establishment. And so what you've got to do is you've got to draw a distinction between who you are and what you stand for and who they are and what you stand for. And you need all the consistently Christian people. You've got to give them a way to know that I am calling for immediate abolition and my opponent is calling for regulation. And so if we try to kind of blend in and call ourselves, you know, pro-lifers, or we try to not draw a distinction, then we're not going to get anywhere. And so we've got to draw a line. We've got to say, here's what abolitionist ideas, candidates, bills look like. And here's what pro-life candidates, ideas, bills look like. And we've got to say, cross this line from pro-life to abolition. And so that's how we draw that clear line of distinction. As we've talked about, we think it's very important that we are biblical in the way that we go about the fight against abortion. For instance, Scott Klusendorf, who's a famous pro-life apologist, he has said, you know, to kind of explain and defend incrementalism, he has said that, you know, you can't fly a 747 using the Bible, basically to say that, you know, the Bible is God's word, but it doesn't necessarily need to guide us in everything. There's certain things that we have to just figure out apart from God's word and be wise from apart from God's word. And sure, as far as, yeah, you're not going to learn how to fly a 747 using the Bible, but removing evil from the land is not the same thing as flying a plane, right? Removing evil from the land is absolutely something that we should be getting our strategies from Scripture in order to do. And so we've got to be Christian about this. Again, abortion is sin. The answer to sin is the gospel. And so we've got to be gospel-centered in the way that we go about fighting abortion. In our argumentation, our bills, everything needs to be consistent with God's word. We are immediatists. We are not gradualists. We don't compromise with abortion. We don't recognize any right to abortion at any point. And we think that's a very important point. As far as exceptions for abortion go, this is they're sometimes referred to as the hard cases, and in some sense they may be difficult. You know, like the case of rape is a hard situation, right? That's an awful, awful crime. I personally think it should be a capital crime. That's a terrible, terrible thing for someone to have to experience. But the case, the moral reasoning on whether or not it should be legal to murder the child that results from rape, that's not a hard situation. It should be very, very easy for us to say, no, they're created in the image of God. You can't murder them. And so the situation is hard, but the moral calculus is not. You shall not murder. That doesn't change just because a situation becomes difficult. Mm. And so rape gets brought up a lot. Incest gets brought up a lot. Like disabilities get brought up a lot. Again, having a disability does not mean you're not creating the image of God. It does not give someone a license to murder you. If you're a 2-year-old and you have a disability, no one should be able to murder you. And that same principle applies to people in the womb, right? We shouldn't be allowed to kill people. As far as the life of the mother situation, this one also gets brought up a lot. Basically what abolition bills do is they just make preborn children and born people equal under the law. And so, I mean, there are triage situations sometimes where a doctor is not going to be able to save 2 patients, right? A doctor has to divert a certain amount of resources to this patient, a certain amount to this patient. I may not be able to save both, but that doctor is not justified in just slitting the throat of one of them because, well, I can't save this one, right? And so, but there are situations where a doctor may not be able to save both. And in those cases, a doctor shouldn't be held accountable for the child dying if the child is unable to be saved. But the doctor must treat the child as a human being. And so we don't want to see any situation in which both the mother and the child die, but we also don't want to have a situation where whenever a pregnancy complication comes up, the easy answer is just go have an abortion. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of situations where there are diseases or illnesses or things that come up, complications, where it's very easy. The easy medical answer is just go have the abortion, and that doesn't give the medical industry incentive to actually work hard to find solutions for these problems. Mm. We want people treated equally under the law, including children in the womb. And so that doesn't change in the case of a pregnancy complication.
And that's so good, because I was actually going to try to play devil's advocate, because I'm trying to think of like, okay, what's our listener? What are they going to be thinking? And like, what questions might they have? And I think you answered quite a few of them. But one of the questions I have that kind of was brought up during the when I was listening to The Liberator was, say you have a baby that it's a stillborn, it's dead in the womb. It's technically, according to many state laws, it's called an abortion to go in and remove the baby from the womb, saving the mother from something like, say, sepsis, and if you were to leave it in there. But I've heard this argument made that if Roe v. Wade goes away, doctors would not be allowed to actually go in and remove that child. I think this happened in Texas because it's considered an abortion, and that mother then is susceptible to disease or infection that might kill her. What kind of response would you guys have to that kind of situation?
Yeah, I would say the definitions in that law probably need to be amended. I would consider abortion to be the intentional killing of a human being. Right? If someone dies of natural causes, you don't charge people for murder, right? So in that instance, I would not consider that abortion. And if a state's, you know, if the state codes define the removal of a miscarried child as an abortion, I would say that those state codes need to be amended.
Yeah.
And I think abolition bills that have been proposed in states where that is the case, I think they actually make that amendment to the state codes.
Right.
But of course, we don't ever want, you know, a deceased miscarried child to remain in the mother. That's not something anyone wants to see.
I think you're talking, I mean, it may be all called abortion, but they're completely different things. I mean, when someone has a stillborn baby, that's a spontaneous abortion. Medically, that's what it's called. When it gets put on a medical record, actually, sometimes I don't even know if they differentiate, you know, whether you got an intentional abortion or it was spontaneous. It might just say abortion, but it's called the same thing. Two different things, you know, intentionally killing your child versus it naturally happening. Two different
things. Right. So, yeah, there's like a legal definition and then there's like a moral definition, and it's unfortunate because the two seem to get intertwined and you can't pull them apart for situations like this. And it's a trigger word, right? Abortion's a trigger word, and you're gonna like offend somebody no matter what you say and who you say it.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, no, it's something for people who are new to it, like, I'm not here to tell you that, like, that's not going to be the case. I mean, it just is the case. Yeah. It's probably becoming less and less the case. You know, it's, I think what may have been like crazy for abolitionists to assert maybe 10 years ago is now seen as a much more normal Christian position. You'll face people being unhappy with you, you know? And that's, you know, I'm not here to say that's not going to be the case. So,
yeah. So anyway, that was the only question or the devil's advocate moment that I had, because you actually answered all of them. So yeah. I'll let you keep going.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. So looks like the next one we got is ignore Roe. And so every abolition bill, it basically says, it directs the attorney general of the state and then the various district attorneys within the state to enforce the abolition of abortion, regardless of what the federal courts say about the matter. Now, this is where it's a thing that a lot of pro-lifers, both politicians and lobbyists and organizations and just people, probably a little less so people, but definitely the politicians and organizations get tripped up here, because they think this idea of ignoring a federal court opinion is just the craziest, most radical, you know, thing ever. And they actually associate it, interestingly, they associate it with the Confederacy, which is a very annoying thing, because it was actually the North that were nullifiers. And one of the reasons explicitly that the Confederates gave for leaving the Union is because they were so angered that the North, the abolitionists in the North, were nullifying the Fugitive Slave Act and were helping escape slaves to freedom. And so the abolitionists were nullifying the evil federal laws, and the Confederacy was so mad about that that they left the Union over it. And so it was actually the abolitionists who were the nullifiers. Huh. This thing of nullification, it's very, very annoying, because politicians will support it for all sorts of things. I mean, they'll support it for marijuana, they'll support it for immigration, they'll support it to protect the Second Amendment. But when it comes to this, they won't support it. They won't support standing up to the federal government on the issue of abortion.
Sorry, real quick. So you're saying, like, this argument or this strategy is being put in place, being practiced today in our nation, and it's working. It holds up in court. So the whole argument by the pro-lifers of this could never happen, this is not a viable option, that's idealistic thinking. Of course, we'd love to see that happen, but it can't happen now. You're saying, no, that's not true. It very easily can happen. It is happening now, just not with this specific issue. So why not this issue?
Right. Yeah. There's a marijuana store on the other side of that wall that proves that is not the case. I mean, here in Oklahoma, it's crazy, because it's actually the champion of the bill to decriminalize marijuana in Oklahoma in defiance of the Gonzalez v. Raich Supreme Court opinion and in defiance of the Federal Controlled Substances Act. The same senator who was the champion of that bill is the senator who denied the Abolition of Abortion in Oklahoma Act a hearing last year. Mm. And so in a lot of cases, it's the same senators who will support nullification on other issues who won't support it on this issue. It is. And it's actually, there's another example too. So that was Greg McCourtney, the guy I was just talking about. Then Senator Greg Treat, who's the pro tem of the Senate, he's the kind of the top dog in the Senate. He authored a bill in 2016 that nullified EPA regulations and stuff related to the Clean Water Act of the Obama administration. Hmm. And so he was the author of that bill. And then in 2019, at a hearing, on abortion, Joseph Silk, the abolitionist senator, stands up and said, let's abolish abortion. And Greg Treat says, no, abolitionists, or sorry, nullifiers are the villains of history. So it's the same guy who was nullifying to stop the EPA from you know, overreaching regulations. And now when it comes to abortion, abolition, or the nullifiers are villains all of a sudden. It really is just speaking out of both sides of their mouth.
Did he call him out on that?
Joseph did, yeah. No, Joseph's awesome. He's not in the Senate anymore. Now he's got his own organization called Liberty Rising. But he was an awesome abolitionist senator. He was the first one, actually, back in 2016. Mm. He was the first sitting legislator to become an abolitionist and put forward a bill of abolition. So Shout out to Joseph.
Awesome. So again, just highlighting, you're saying the states have the legal right to nullify any federal law that is unconstitutional. And I think on your website, you go deeper than that and say, even though the Constitution gives us this legal right in this nation, beyond that, we have the biblical and Christian responsibility to stand against evil laws, which obviously murdering your child or murdering a child or a preborn baby is, you know, an evil law.
Right. Yeah. No, a good example that I like to use for this is the Nuremberg trials, right? And so in Nuremberg, all these Nazi officials were basically on trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And what their excuse was, well, I'm just following orders. Like, I wasn't Hitler. I wasn't Himmler. Like, I wasn't the one coming up with this stuff. I'm just doing what I'm told to do. And they got executed, and rightly so, because when you're told to do that, even if it's the law, you should know inherently that there's a law. You do know inherently that there's a law above the law of your land. And so if the law of your land is telling you commit murder or allow murder, you know that you shouldn't go along with that. And so, yeah, we do have a constitution that is pretty good in a lot of ways. I would say there's some things I would amend about it, but it has some good concepts there. And it has the right to life. It has the right to equal protection. We just have to uphold the actual constitution that all of our officials take an oath to. And then, yeah, as you said, even if our constitution was totally evil and it didn't have any right to life, didn't have a right to equal protection, didn't have a right to due process and all that, even if it didn't, we should still abolish abortion immediately because it's the right thing to do.
So why do you think pro-lifers, they don't understand this, a lot of them, or they do and they're just ignoring it because it doesn't fit with their agenda? You know, because it seems, you know, I didn't know about it before, but when you lay it out to me and you point to examples of this commonly happening in our nation, you're like, well, of course. So there is a way to end it right now, you know. And so why do you think they say, you know, it's not possible, or when there's a bill, you know, presented, you know, they stand against it?
Yeah, it's a mixed bag, I think, and I wouldn't want to treat them all the same. I think there are some who are well-meaning, I think, or I know there are some who are well-meaning, people who I've worked with. But I also think there are some who their life is fighting to regulate abortion. That's what they've done ever since the mid-1970s. And so this is what they do. And their legacy is all these incremental pro-life victories. And so when a new group comes along and says, no, that's not what you should have been doing for the last 30, 40 years, we should have been calling it murder and abolishing it, that's a major hit to their pride and kind of what they identify that it's something they put their life's work into. And so they identify with it very closely. And so when you say, no, incremental regulations aren't good, abolish abortion, it's very, very difficult for them to give that up, to admit this wasn't right. It's also probably for some of them, it's very difficult for them to give up the prospect of a prestigious, well-paying position. I mean, I think for some of them, that is the case. Not all of them. I don't want to say all pro-lifers are in it, you know, for bad reasons. But yeah, I think it's a mix of pride in not being able to change what they've been doing for a long time. And then I think there's also a lot of just pro-lifers, mostly the normal people. I think a lot of people at the top, I think they know and they've rejected abolitionism to a certain degree out of pride. But I think there's a lot of also just people out there who've, you know, like me as of 3 years ago and like you guys, you know, as of recently, there's a lot of people out there who just haven't heard these ideas. And then when they do, it clicks because it's like, yeah, that is right. That is biblical. I need to go do that. And so, yeah, it's a mixed bag. I think there's people who mean well. I think there's probably some of the head people in the pro-life movement who may not have the best motives.
Awesome. So that kind of leads us to your last tenet there, which is criminalization. And I think this one is probably one of the hardest for people. I think it was even Tyler and I were talking about this. How does this, walk us through, what do you mean by that? How does this work? Is this the biggest stumbling block for people?
Yes. So the defying the Supreme Court and this criminalizing abortion are the two big ones for people. But there are three reasons I give for why abortion must be made a criminal act. And when I say abortion must be made a criminal act, what I mean by that is that I'm not shying away from any of the implications of that, including the fact that the mother should be held accountable for paying someone to murder her child. Now, pro-lifers disagree. Every pro-life bill says the mother shall be immune from any prosecution. Abolition bills don't have that line saying the mother is immune from prosecution. And there are three reasons that I give for why that's very important that we don't give that immunity to them. The first one being that if you give that immunity to them, they still have a right to do-it-yourself abortions. And so there are lots of organizations on, you can just Google it, and you can have abortion pills shipped straight to your door with instructions about how to, do every single part of the thing. And so there's no abortionist to prosecute, right? It's just people ordering stuff online and having the abortion themselves. And that's perfectly legal. There's no one to prosecute there. That is a legal thing to do, in that instance. And so, when you give the mother immunity, you are legalizing self-induced abortion. And so you're not actually abolishing abortion. You can't abolish abortion when one of the principal people involved is given immunity in all cases. Now, that's not to say that mothers shouldn't be given immunity in some cases. Like there are some legitimate instances in which the mother is a victim. She was forced to have the abortion mm-hmm. under threat of bodily harm, and she absolutely should not be held liable for that in court. That's not her fault. She was forced at gunpoint, and I believe in every single state there are laws that protect people who are coerced into committing crimes under threat of bodily harm. And so we're not saying that every mother shouldn't be immune, but we're just saying you've got to treat each case according to the facts of the case. You can't just give immunity to every mother, and if you do, you're actually legalizing self-induced abortion. Mm. The number two reason is that penalties are deterrents. And so, we, for the States, we put on a conference every year. And at our conference in 2020, we had a lot of post-abortive mothers give testimonies. And what they said, just one after the other, I would not have done this. Like if I was looking at murder charges, my child would be here today. Mm-hmm. And not just mother, we've had post-abortive fathers say that, at conferences and at committee hearings. Penalties are a deterrent. The law is supposed to guide people away from evil things like murdering your own child. And so this idea that we're going to leave self-induced abortion on the table for people to choose with impunity, that's not loving. You're allowing them to do something that's going to destroy their soul. It's going to destroy their child. There's nothing loving about that. The law should guide people away from these sorts of evil decisions. And if you are leaving self-induced abortion legal, you're giving people no incentive not to murder their own child. And so we've got to use the law to guide people away from murdering their children. So that's the number two reason. Penalties are a deterrent. The number three reason is that giving full immunity to the mother in all cases is an inconsistency that undermines us both just in the case against abortion, in the court of public opinion, and in actual courts of law. I'm going to read a little section here from the actual Roe v. Wade decision. This is Justice Harry Blackmun, who's the author of that decision. And he writes, "There are other inconsistencies between 14th Amendment status and a typical abortion statute. It has already been pointed out that in Texas, the woman is not a principal or an accomplice with respect to an abortion upon her. If the fetus is a person, why is the woman not a principal or an accomplice? Further, the criminal penalty for abortion specified by Article 1195 is significantly less than the maximum penalty for murder prescribed by Article 1257 of the Texas Penal Code. If the fetus is a person, may the penalties be different?" And so what he's saying there is, If the state of Texas, if you're going to come into court and argue that the unborn child is a person who deserves the equal protection of the laws, you can't have laws on your books which allow people to murder them with impunity, because no one else can be murdered with impunity. And you can't have laws on your books saying that the abortionist only gets 2 to 5 year sentence when everyone else gets 25 to life or the death penalty. You can't say they're people, the unborn child is a person, but then treat them differently and allow people to kill them with impunity. You have to treat them the same as any other person if you're going to actually argue that they're a person. And so we can't undermine ourselves, basically.
I think there was a quote on your website, and I forget who it was by, and I'm paraphrasing again, but basically saying, you know, making abortion a criminal act and including the parents in that doesn't mean that we're going to be charging millions of mothers and fathers. Yeah. It means that a few will do it because, like you said, it's a deterrent, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, no, that's, you know, I've got the few examples that I gave of testimonies given at hearings and conferences. And then Laura Klassen, who is an activist from Canada who's become an abolitionist, she did kind of an informal poll on her Facebook page. And I don't know how many, but it was a lot to one who said that I would not have, the a lot saying I would not have had the abortion if abortion were actually treated as murder. Mm. And yeah, you know, sure, there may be a few who there will be a few, right? There are people who, even though murder gets treated as murder, people still murder each other, right? It's not going to get rid of all murder, right? People still do evil things to each other, and even despite the penalties. But a lot of people would not be doing this if they were looking at first degree murder. We're not charging a million mothers each year with murder. It's going to be a much, much lower number.
It's interesting how a father could kill his pregnant wife and be charged with double homicide.
Yeah.
And, you know, when the mother decides to take the life, they're not charged with anything, which is just an interesting comparison. I'm not saying one way or another, but this is just a thing that's kind of open for discussion. We had a guest last week on the episode who had an abortion, and it was very interesting because it was like the culture in a way kind of... The culture has this like propaganda, right? It makes you think that there's only two ways. You can either have the child or you kill the child. And this guest that we had, it was very like, it's like the culture was pressing down on her, kind of forcing her to make the decision to abort the child. So I just wonder, like, kind of open for a discussion, if mothers are partially victims too, in some cases, like you were mentioning earlier, where they don't really have any other options. They're a confused young woman who is just trying to figure it out. And the culture is saying, you know, you have to end this little life. And where do they go from there, you know, other than just following what they're being told? And it's such a difficult conversation and such a sensitive topic. And yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I touched on it just very briefly, but it's a good point to expand upon. I would say for people like that are, in addition to the preborn child first, but people like that are who it's also extremely important to abolish abortion for, because someone like that who does feel the pressure from whomever it was, I don't know who it was in this instance, whether it was her boyfriend or husband or parents, whoever it was, wherever that pressure was coming from, if it's murder and any accomplices to that crime get charged with murder, those people aren't going to make themselves accomplices to that crime. And there aren't going to be abortionists out there who are going to make themselves accomplices to the crime, or at least, you know, like I said, very, very few who are willing to risk that. And so, it's important to abolish abortion so that people in that vulnerable instance aren't guided toward this thing that's going to do all this damage to their child first, but also to them. And so there's nothing loving about leaving the option to choose murder on the table for people like your guest last week, or for the people who've spoke at our conference. And we actually had a post-abortive guest on as well to our podcast, I think maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago, Sonia Ganella. And she'll just straight up say it, I wish abortion had been murder, and I never would have done this. So
yeah, I think one thing we struggle with is we kind of put in, we look at these like criminalizing abortion and we think the outcomes are going to be the same as they are right now. Like our cultural norms, our practices, the decisions we make we're going to do the same thing now. Yeah. And we come up with problems that won't actually be problems. If it was illegal across the board, if it was murder, you know, we wouldn't have, you know, these young people confused with the most of the culture saying it's okay to do and whitewashing it, not telling, you know, we're just taking your problem, not calling it murder, you know, with them, all these things, it will be pretty clear, like, it's wrong to do, because everybody will know you'll be charged with murder. It's, you know, again, like yeah. the guy on the website, you know, was saying, it's not like we'll be charging millions of people, fathers and mothers. We'll be charging a few who will do it anyway, knowing that it's murder, knowing they could be charged with murder. So, so maybe we're coming up with problems that, you know, won't be real.
Right. Yeah. People talk a lot about how politics is downstream from culture. And I agree with that. But I think a part that gets left out is that the influence goes both ways. Culture affects politics. Politics affects culture, because the law is a tutor. And so the laws that we pass have an educational effect on the culture. And so, you know, another objection that gets brought up to criminalization is that people say, well, these people, they've been brainwashed. They don't know that a preborn child is a human being. And I would mostly reject that notion. I think I would think just about everybody has graduated sixth grade, right? We know where babies come from when life begins. But let's grant the point. There are some women out there or men out there who really don't know when life begins and that the child in the womb is a child. Well, how do we teach them? We can pass a law saying abortion's murder and life begins at conception. Like that's the best way I can think of to teach any remaining people in the culture who don't yet know that. That's how you would reach a lot of people like that at once.
As we kind of wind down, can you just give us an update on what's going on politically with the abortion debate? What are the laws being passed for or against? But specifically, what's the progress that's being made for the abolition of abortion? You know, and I didn't even know this. I didn't know there were abolition bills out there and states pushing for this. Can you give us an update on the progress that's being made?
Yeah, so this is an exciting thing to talk about, because we are in a lot of states now. There are bills in Oklahoma, Texas, Indiana, Missouri, Idaho, Arizona, Alaska, South Carolina. There was one in Washington State last year, but I don't think there will be this year. But yeah, I mean, we're up near a dozen states now. And not only is the growth legislatively really exciting, but the growth within the church is really exciting, especially here in Oklahoma. Here in Oklahoma, we've got the Oklahoma Baptists, which is the SBC affiliated convention here. And we've got the Oklahoma Association of Free Will Baptists, have both passed resolution calling for total and immediate abolition without any compromise. And those resolutions both got passed in 2019, 2 years ago. And so I think the growth of legislators around the country converting to abolitionism is very, very exciting. But the growth of abolitionism in the church is very, very exciting. And like here in Oklahoma, we've got maybe, you know, 15, 20 active abolitionist pastors. I mean, the abortion clinics, the five abortion clinics here in Oklahoma are just packed almost every single morning. And with churches basically saying, hey, I'll take Monday. This church takes Tuesday. This church takes Wednesday. I mean, the churches are really getting involved. And so that's a very, very exciting thing to see. To me, even more so than the legislators, you know, the representatives and senators who are converting to abolitionism, I would take a pastor over a legislator as far as the ability that they have to change the culture. And so just to see guys like Brett Baggett and Dusty Devers and Tim Gillespie, Sam Ketcher, all these guys, lots I can't mention. I would have to go on for a long time to mention them all. Chris Gordon, all those guys, Bill Askell, but it's really, really exciting to see. And also, I mean, Christian podcasts as well. I mean, this is like the fourth one that someone from Free the States has been on in the last couple of weeks. Lots of podcasts are taking interest. I won't out anybody, but people within various pro-life organizations are taking interest. I think their job security may be in trouble if I were to mention names here, but we are a movement that is growing quickly, growing in legislatures, growing within churches. And so, yeah, it's exciting to see, exciting to be a part of. And so, yeah, it's a cool thing that God's doing.
So James, as we conclude today, is there anything else that you would want to say to our listeners and how they can learn more about you guys and learn more about the abolitionist movement and how they could possibly get involved?
Yeah. So I would definitely recommend going to freethestates.org. kind of the concepts that we've talked about. Some of the stuff on the website was kind of used as a template for that. So you can just go there to get more on any of the topics that we've talked about. We actually just launched a store, and the product that I'm most excited about is this pamphlet here. It just kind of goes through the tenets of abolitionism and through the components of an abolition bill. And so I would highly recommend picking up this pamphlet if you want to just kind of get the abolition, if you want to get to know abolitionism 101, go to store.freethestates.org, get this pamphlet. Send us a message, a contact form, if you want to get connected with abolitionists in your area. We are an Oklahoma-based organization, but we have organizations that we partner with in states all over the place. And so if you want to get connected with people in your area, just go ahead to our website, fill out our contact form, tell us where you live, and we'll get you plugged in wherever you are. And also happy to answer any of the questions you have. If you want to just fill out our contact form or send us a message on Facebook, however you want to do it. So
they have one piece of merch that I found really helpful, actually. It's the, are you a pro-lifer or are you an abolitionist? Like, it's, I think it's like a pamphlet where it kind of gives the criteria.
It's
for
like
both.
A Facebook survey, but
okay. Yeah, in a way.
Yeah,
it's super helpful.
Is it, let's see, where is it? I think that's a page of the pamphlet, I believe.
It might be, yeah.
Or, yeah, here.
I think it was like...
That there?
That's it. That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
That's it. Yeah. Pages 16 and 17 of the pamphlet.
Awesome.
It has the, for those of you who are listening, it's has the distinctives between an abolitionist bill and a pro-life bill. Surprising stuff in there. You might find a lot of interest in it. So I'm going to link their website in the episode description so you can go check it out for yourself.
All right. Well, as we close, James, I just want to thank you again for taking the time to be with us today. Like I said, especially on such short notice, kudos for you for making that happen. You know, we're thankful for all you guys are doing in the fight against abortion and fighting for the abolition of abortion. And, you know, we're praying that God would bless those efforts and bless you guys. To our listeners, thank you for joining us on another episode of the Happy Holy Hour. You know, take this conversation to heart and prayerfully consider how you can get involved. James has given us a lot of great information, so definitely follow up on some of those materials. Remember to subscribe and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast. You can join the conversation and follow along by joining us on social media, or you can learn more about us and access tons of free content by visiting www.thehappyholyhour.org, and consider financially supporting the podcast on Patreon or GoFundMe to help us share the gospel around the world and to bring often neglected but important conversations to the table. Until next time, grace and peace.